All right, welcome everybody. We're back for a second iteration of our podcast. I'm here with Mark Bell. Mark, say hi.
Hello, everyone.
And we're with Neil Pawar.
Hello.
It's great to have you, Neil. My name is Klaus Box. I'm the Emory Center for Alternative Investments. I'm the director of it. I'm a professor here at Emory together with Mark. So super excited to have you here, Neil. Welcome to Emory. It's your first time here at Emory, I believe. Is that right?
First time on campus. Super excited to be here. And you brought the weather out for me, so I'm blessed.
Amen. It's what we do. So tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, so I'm a programmer by background. I studied computer science at Brown. And I knew nothing about finance, but ended up, when I graduated, realizing that the finance companies were doing more interesting stuff than any other part of technology. This is back in 1994. And so I ended up joining an options trading firm in Chicago called O'Connor. And 27 years later, after a couple of hops in between, I'm still at it and loving it.
That's awesome. Mark, you brought Neil in. Tell me a little bit, what's your background with Neil?
Absolutely. So Neil and I started working together when he was leading the technology effort at D.E. Shaw. And D.E. Shaw at that time was relying on its ability to find and analyze big data sets in an effort to get edge, in an effort to kind of develop unique investment ideas. And so Neil was running that effort. And at the time, Neil not only had a pretty big team in New York, but he had a really burgeoning team in India. And I think ultimately we at one point may have had more people in India firm-wide than we did in New York. And so Neil was working on the most interesting kind of problems at the firm, and I left in part to come back down here, but Neil stayed and was at D. Shaw, I think, for about a decade, maybe 11 years.
That's right.
And so tell us a little bit about your time at D. Shaw. What was different today than maybe, in the world of technology and finance, and what kind of took you out of Shaw?
And maybe to even add to that, enlighten our audience here how you combine being a programmer and a coder. You've been very successful in finance, and kind of how you kind of mix those two things together.
Well, it's a great question, Klaus, because, if you're writing software to automate or build models around particular financial concepts, I always say you have to be able to speak both languages, right? You have to be able to speak finance and you have to be able to code. And back in the day in the 90s, nobody cared that much about the software side. And so we would just sort of be in the back office somewhere writing code. And over the last 25 years, it's become more and more important. A lot of that is because companies like D.E. Shaw really broke ground in how they use data. And now everybody wants data, wants to use it in interesting ways. And so to be good at what we did, you eventually had to learn a dangerous amount about the business and about finance. And now today, as Chief Operating Officer of Qontigo, we run DAX and stocks, the German and Swiss indices. And I'm, running product operations and technology for them, which for me is a dream because now, I'm finally on the business side of what I do as well as technology. And, working your way up through sort of every level from entry level to that level, you learn a lot about how the systems work and interconnect.
That's fantastic. I will tell you, I'm working with a company in the music space, and they collect an enormous amount of data. One of the big challenges that we have is sort of how to use that data to actually make better business decisions. And we are, but it's always a fight to figure out what is the next frontier. How can we think about using that data to actually do more in that business? So I totally relate to what you're saying. It's an ongoing, I guess, arms race between different companies, kind of what data they use and sort of how to, what was interesting a decade ago, sort of now that's commonplace probably. So.
You might remember, since you're into music, there was Pandora, right?
Yeah.
And Pandora had, it based its recommendations not off what other people liked, but off this thing called the Music Genome Project, where they literally sort of tagged every song with about 150 different parameters. This was done by sort of musicologists around the world. They crowdsourced it. And off that data set, they were able to build, at least at the time, what I thought were amazing playlists. There was no Spotify back then. And I was fascinated by this data set and even wrote to them to try and get my hands on it because I had this theory. Music is very derivative. And if you listen to the chord sequences of songs, you can find a lot of songs that they're actually the same song, 30 years later, same chord progression, number one hit.
Yeah.
And I thought, could you reverse engineer, great music by sort of mining all the information about the music, the chords, but also the genome of every song to try and predict what is going to make the little, you know, dopamine fire off in my brain when I hear a song that I like. Didn't get very far, but it was, you know, I was thinking, you know, I was inspired by what we were doing at D.E. Shaw, which was those kinds of things, but with other types of data sets. So we would mine super interesting data sets that were publicly available, and then, you know, run back tests and try and figure out like what we could do with that stuff.
But finish that story real quick with Pandora. Where we are today,
yeah,
is the crowd is creating those playlists. Is that where the Spotify's and the other kind of music apps are happening, and kind of this wisdom of the collective, so-called, in quotes?
That's right, because every time you're using Spotify, you're creating data.
Right.
And that data is going into their, you know, big data repositories, and they're running analysis against that and building playlists. So it's less about now the craftsmanship of trying to, you know, tag every song mm-hmm. with the right labels. It's now like there's just it's easier to do it off the millions of customers that they have. But pre-Spotify, people were trying to find other ways of connecting interests and like-mindedness.
The interesting thing, I think, today, though, producers use that very technique, if I'm not mistaken, where they look at songs that have been successful in the past mm-hmm. or that have caught commercial success, and what kind of rhythms and patterns they can recognize in those songs and replicate that to new songs.
That's exactly right. And the idea I was playing with at the time was, can you do that algorithmically? Like, I don't need the producer. I'm going to run the algorithm, and it's going to tell me what kind of music, you know, my artist should sing next.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Contigo, what y'all do, and what kind of the challenges and opportunities set in front of y'all as a company, particularly around data, finance, investing.
Yeah, so Contigo is about a three-year-old company, and it comes from the merger of two businesses, one called Axioma, and you guys might know Axioma because they were one of the pioneers in building portfolio optimization software, factor models, and things like that, used heavily by asset managers and hedge funds around the world. And Stocks and DAX, which is the indexing businesses. And the reason these companies are brought together, they're owned, by the way, by Deutsche Börse, the German Stock Exchange Group, and General Atlantic Partners. And the reason they thought that was a good idea to bring these two together is because passive index investing is becoming more and more quantitative. And so what we're finding, for example, our clients, pension funds, asset managers, wealth managers, are looking for, you know, they don't just want passive indices, they want thematic tilts on those indices. Now, one flavor of thematic tilts is ESG, which we've talked about previously, but that's only one flavor. We've recently launched a product which is a metaverse index, right? And you go, well, how do I build a data set that tells me what companies have, you know, affinity to metaverse concepts? And, you know, we're using a company that's built AI that reads patents, every patent filed in the world, to understand which companies are doing stuff in spaces in and around the metaverse. And we're using that to build a thematic index tilt on a passive index benchmark.
Wow. And so the idea is to just generate more, I guess, index products for customers, consumers. These are probably listed products. So you would work, Contigo works for, say, a big bank, Deutsche Bank, JP Morgan, to create these products or other investment houses?
Yeah, like asset managers or ETF providers. So they'll work with companies like BlackRock or DWS or UBS to basically build the passive investable product that then gets put into an ETF wrapper and sold into retail or wealth.
So today there's a meta index, a metaverse index?
There's a metaverse index and, a number of other climate-related ones and things along those lines. And again, they're all constructed with data, right? And so you've got to either build those data sets yourself or buy them from vendors, curate them, and then use them in the portfolio construction for the resulting investable index.
So there are a lot of things that folks are enthusiastic about. It might be AI, self-driving cars. It might be crypto. It might be things like ESG, which you've mentioned. It might be things like Meta. And there seems to be a proliferation of products that allow for them to invest in a liquid or semi-liquid way. But the investment experience, the return sequence is very different.
Yeah.
So if I have a robot ETF and you have a robot ETF, the returns to me seem to have to be very divergent. Like, why is that the case?
Well, I mean, when you're building thematic indices, for example, There are sort of broadly two ways you can do that. One is you can create lists of good companies and bad companies, and you can say, I'm going to take the bad companies out of the index and maybe substitute them with other things. And when you do that, you're naturally going to create a much bigger tracking error. Mm. And the way we try to do it is using our portfolio optimization software, we're able to, you know, tilt the portfolio, which means we might change the weights within that such that in a measurable way, we can show the impact, but we can also show the tracking error. And running a 5 or 10 year back test, depending on how far back the data set gets, you can have a pretty good idea of what the tracking error on that portfolio would be through different times and what its performance, you know, profile looks like.
Totally, totally kind of orthogonal question. A lot of my understanding is a lot of the data that y'all provide enables tax loss harvesting and kind of real-time tax loss harvesting, which has gone from being very, very sophisticated to increasingly commonplace.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Does the speeding up of tax loss harvesting, in your mind at all, intellectually challenge the reason the tax law is set up in that way? Is that does that change how we should think about people taking losses if they can take them intraday and on a passive basis?
I mean, isn't there always sort of an interesting sort of lag between sort of laws and the way people respond to them, you know? And so naturally, I think that, you know, there are techniques that are completely, you know, legitimate that
Absolutely
people use in tax structuring and tax loss harvesting that perhaps look like you're getting some sort of edge, but you're really not. And it's about the laws now having to catch up.
So let me get, and this is new to me. So you're creating an index product that's effectively, say, an S&P with the tax loss harvesting built in?
Although typically the people that use our tax loss harvesting capabilities are running separately managed accounts that follow a model portfolio for, you know, so there's a model portfolio that the chief investment officer comes out with for a particular risk class of client. And then any client that matches that risk class has a separately managed account where they're owning fractional shares of all of the individual equities in that portfolio. And then the optimizer is able to do tax loss harvesting on those individual portfolios.
Interesting. So this would compete with like an Aprio which other ones do we have?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And through their software, they're able to introduce, as they were saying with the ESG and whatnot, very, very low tracking errors. So you'll track very close to that model portfolio, if not right on it.
That's amazing.
I
would love.
Powerful.
I've always wondered what the optimal, you know, my non-sophisticated, non-data-driven way on how to think about how should I do tax loss harvesting? How often should you rebalance?
Yeah.
I don't think those questions. Very interesting. You guys probably have a quantitative answer then to those questions that is completely driven by data rather than sort of like, hey, we should do it every quarter or when we have a big downturn, that's the only time we optimize. Should you do it every 2 years, every 1 year when you file your taxes?
No, and to be fair, many of the clients that buy that software from us have, you know, their own theories on that. And so we're giving them the tools to be able to do that, but their own quants and their own CIOs are making those actual decisions on rebalance frequency and harvesting frequency and when, because there isn't like a perfect answer to that. And so, you know, that in a way is the alpha or the edge that one firm might have over the other.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, my whole philosophy about sort of this type of software is that 20 years ago, you built all of this yourself.
Yeah.
And what's happened is now components of that have become more and more commoditized. And like, I love selling commodities, you know, everybody needs an optimizer to do these things by hours. But what you're optimizing for, what your objective function is, what your constraints are, I mean, that's part of what your quants are doing. Now, we do it for you when we build an index for you, but we also sell all the components to do it yourself, which is what asset managers and hedge funds have been doing for
Very
the last 20 years.
Very interesting.
So it's interesting to take that 20-year perspective because 20 years ago, you were, you know, on the bleeding edge of kind of quantitative finance or this emerging field of StatArb. And then running technology for UBS, which is $3 trillion, $2 trillion, AQR, and now Contigo. If you had to think about what will be different 10, 15, 20 years from now, you know, the commoditization of some of these tools that used to be proprietary for the folks like a D.E. Shaw, that's one thing you've mentioned. What are the other things you think the students today will see when they're mid-career?
I think you'll see mass customization.
Can I add on to that? And yeah, what are you very excited about?
Like, well, what are the same answer for both.
Yeah, all right, all right.
Mass customization. I mean, when I talk to my banker right now and I say, you know, my values are, I care about climate change, I care about this, I care about that. What can you give me from an investment portfolio perspective? Mostly what they do is they look up funds that have the word ESG in them. That's not what I'm looking for. And so I think, you know, if you're ultra high net worth, you can sit down and they can put together a very custom bespoke product for you. But mass affluent and retail doesn't have that option. I think that the same way we're seeing the tools that we use in quantitative finance 20 years ago that you charged, you know, 3% management fee for, you can now buy for, you know, 10 basis points type thing. I think that same level of commoditization brings those products to retail, but in a very sort of accessible way, right? So it's got to be, you know, people have to be able to sort of explain what their values are and then have a portfolio built for them that really sort of pushes investments in their values, but doesn't give up too much performance either, right? They want to see their returns match the S&P 500 or whatever the benchmark that they're benchmarked to, but they want to be able to see lower greenhouse gas emissions, for example. And there are now ways to do that. They're not widely used yet, and I think they're still in the early innings. And as we all know, I mean, ESG data is not a science yet, and it's something that's starting to get more regulated, and people are recognizing there's a, you know, you really have to understand what's inside those data sets and how they're constructed. But I think as that starts to get more mature, customization for anybody that has any amount of investable assets. So you see the robo-advisors doing this now in a small way. But when you look at the total size of robo-advisors and compare them to the big wealth managers, they're tiny.
Yeah.
They're really successful, but they're tiny.
Yeah.
And so, like, when does that become the way everybody invests? I think we're moving in that direction.
Talk about robo for a second because, you know, do you believe robos swallow the world and traditional financial advisors like myself eventually are replaced by a better, more customized, you know, piece of software that, to your point, can pull out of the client really what they want, what they're actually looking for versus Mark's idea of what they need?
I think it's always going to be a combination, but I think what changes is if Mark is trying to manage the portfolios of 250 clients, Mark can't do that by himself. He needs tools to do that. And so depending on what segment you're in, I think it's going to be a combination. Now, obviously, when you're in the ultra high net worth segment that have very bespoke white glove needs, you might be only managing 5 clients and you're doing that super well. But if you're managing 250 or 1,000, how do you do that well without technology? Mm-hmm. And so I think, and if you look, I mean, a lot of the wealth managers are buying the robo-advisors, right? They're buying them to basically grow their footprint into the mass affluent sort of segment and to give their advisors the ability to drive outcomes for a much larger number of people. They're also, you know, the other thing I observe is that the chief investment officers, 15, 20 years ago would write research papers and advisors would sort of read them and say, okay, I'm still going to do what my gut tells me, but thanks for the advice. And now, I mean, they're calling the shots. I mean, that's really where they decide what the strategic asset allocations are and what the different sleeves are, and that flows down into the organization. And not to say that the advisors don't have discretion, but they certainly have less discretion than they had a decade ago.
It's interesting, I think, if you think about it, and, you know, I'd love to hear your perspective on it, Mark. When we think about wealth management, I always think, yes, part of it investing, but the other part, frankly, is sort of what we've seen coming out of the University of Chicago, which is behavioral finance.
It's really
the recognition that most people do the wrong things at the wrong time. So no computer, I think. It's very hard for computers to guard against that. Selling at the wrong time, for example.
I would say, Dr. Box, that knowing for us families' personalities and their needs and their behavioral biases and their objectives, investments are a huge part of how they achieve those, but by no means the only part. And so maybe along the lines of what Neil's saying is if the money management of that is increasingly done highly effectively and better by software than by a guy waking up saying, I think Apple's going to go down or up today. You know, that part of the business gets increasingly dependent on that software.
Neil, go ahead.
Oh, I would be interested in asking Neil. Neil's built a huge business in India. He's worked in Manhattan. Currently, I guess you're headquartered in Frankfurt with offices here in Atlanta. You lived in Switzerland. You know, you've thought about the explosion of kind of wealth in emerging Asia. Talk to us and kind of our international students and listeners about what you see as the similarities and difference in this kind of global competitive capital environment. Like, what's the same across those places and what's very different?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, for one, just looking between Europe and the US, for example, the US isn't as worried about climate change as Europe is. Mm-hmm. And so our institutional investors are asking a lot more demands from us from mm-hmm. an ESG perspective yeah. than we see in the US.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when I talk to friends out in Asia, there's a lot more interest in crypto. And, you know, we're actually working on very early stage, but working on a crypto index of actual protocols and tokens, not just companies that do distributed ledger type stuff. And so, but again, you know, the patterns and the tools to apply are the same.
Right.
And so as long as you can turn it into sort of a data stream that's back testable, that has a temporal nature to it, it's really interesting. You can still construct portfolios that way. The themes may change based on region.
And for our students and students here, as they think about how to get international exposure, I mean, what is your thoughts around how important it is to work or live abroad? How important has that been for your career development?
Hugely, hugely important. I mean, on a number of levels. I would say, first of all, just, you know, especially in the world in the last 3 years where we've learned that pretty much anyone can do their jobs from anywhere, you know, it makes you realize that when you think about talent pools, you can tap into talent mm-hmm. pools just about anywhere. Now, DeShaw was way ahead of their time with, you know, how much they were doing in India, you know, sort of in 1999, 2000. Now everybody has a footprint in India and China, mm-hmm. you know, in LATAM. And so I think, you know, while, of course, you can work with people all over the world while sitting in Manhattan, you learn so much more about the culture by being there, but also about, you know, how the university systems work there and like the strengths and weaknesses of different programs. And so for me, it's been amazing, you know, also growing up in Bombay and London as a kid to have all of those experiences. It allows you to almost sort of become a local when you're in each of those regions and be almost a chameleon in a way that, you know, endears yourself to people that you're doing business with in those locations as well.
Great. All right. Last question before we're going to wrap up. Any more ideas that you want to share? You've done a lot of different things. Your presentations every year, they're different when you talk to our students. What is your hottest idea? What are you so excited about when you look out into the world and excited to see?
I have this crazy idea I've been mulling for a while. I think I just bought the domain name for it. And it's called Karma Footprint. And the idea is you upload your, you know, your Amex bill, your credit card bill, your bank statement, you know, into this app, and it analyzes all the things you buy, and it looks at them from a supply chain perspective, and it tells you whether the things you're buying have exposure to fast fashion or to, you know, sort of, you know, child labor in certain parts of the world and things like that, and then offers you alternative brands that you should be buying instead. So the idea is that it generates like a karmic score for the way you live your life just based on looking at the data stream of receipts and things that you generate through your life. And I haven't figured out how to monetize it yet or even how to build it. But but every time I pitch it to people, they go, that'd be kind of interesting. Like, I'd like to know more about, you know, my spending habits. And, you know, I'm excited when Amex just tells me how much I spend on Uber every year. But to actually go one level deeper than that could be quite cool.
That's awesome. What a great idea. Never thought about that. Neil, great to have you for our second podcast. Mark Bell, always great to have you.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here, Dr. Box. Thank you.
Awesome. Great to have you guys.
See ya.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.